So this morning we have a presentation for you on free will and the Cavalarian philosophy. And as our speaker will mention to you, this was sparked by a question, a topic that was sent in to our email address, talktopics@cavalarians.com, with a point that they wanted us to discuss. And so we think, well, what's the importance of free will? And yet, as you will learn, it is not only basic, but it is very important to consider science and in law and in religion and in the concept of ethics, that we have to take responsibility for what we do, and free will is part of that, taking responsibility. So this morning, as you can see, we have a dialogue, a two-person panel, and the person responsible for the presentation this morning to a great degree is Stephanie Lubbock, and she has been instrumental in developing the Principles in Action course. She has taught a number of the courses, the Principles in Action and the Cycle Management Training courses. And she is a school teacher at one time and now a music teacher in her own life and happens to be my wife. And so we will hopefully have a very interesting dialogue. So please give a big welcome to Stephanie to talk about free will and the Cavalarian philosophy. Are you there, Stephanie? Good morning.
And by the way, good morning, everyone. Thank you for being with us. As was mentioned, the topic was suggested by a listener. And the question, I'll just read in part, was if our life is based on a mathematical principle, immutable, and we are birth path inclined and name moved, how are we free from this law of either determinism or free will? And so this opened up a little research on the topics of free will versus determinism. It's not a new debate, but there have been discussions and theories on these two points for many years. Harrison's going to touch a little bit on the historical background. But I thought we should start with maybe a few points about theories in general. There are so many theories trying to make sense of life, from the ancient notions of the Greek gods to so-called modern chaos theory, although I don't think chaos is a new invention either. So as sincere students of the Cavalarian philosophy, we need to keep certain things in mind. Number one, we should recognize that these theories may be very sincere attempts to make sense of life. And equally, they are sometimes just vehicles for ego and self-promotion, somebody who wants to make a name for themselves. So we have to be aware of both the source of the information and the logic. Number two, our ethics of right thinking admonish us always to give credit to others, even though they may not have discovered the true light of wisdom. And so if we see flaws in a theory, it behooves us to identify those and be on guard against weaknesses in a theory, but still be respectful. Number three, as students, we must recognize that analyzing a different theory is in no way showing a lack of respect for our principle, provided we approach it with analysis and we recognize that there is always a danger in any school of thinking if we're not alert, if we're not analytical, and continually comparing the theory to what we have learned to know and trust. So it's always a good idea to begin with what we know, what we believe. And the Cavalarian philosophy is all about universal principles. It's basic, it's comprehensive, and it covers all facets of life, physical, mental, and spiritual. Virtually there is no topic that cannot be handled by a philosophical mind in a philosophical manner, if we are willing to put forth that effort. Without that very complete and universal perspective, any system is liable to have flaws. So, having looked at those the preliminaries, where does the Caballerian philosophy stand on these topics of free will and determinism? Let's just briefly look at terms. One who believes in the existence of free will holds that a person's choices are self-determined. In other words, one can make a choice to act a certain way, regardless of or despite his or her determinants, and that point will be defined in a moment. And a Webster's definition is that free will is the power asserted of moral beings of choosing within limitations or with respect to some matters without restraint of physical or divine necessity or causal law. In other words, you accept some responsibility for what your choices might be. You don't subscribe to the theory that, as for example, 100 years ago there was a very popular church movement that said, you're predestined for heaven or hell. Can't do much about it. So free will would not accept that. It would say that we have choices. Now, determinism, there is a website with a number of articles that can be researched, but one significant part of the definition is that our behavior is always determined by prior events and the resultant beliefs we hold and our genes. That the reasons we act in a certain way is beyond our control. In fact, it's a quote from Schopenhauer that a man can surely do what he wills to do, but cannot determine what he will. So the determinist theory is that despite our feelings that we have a choice and that we can act as we please, in fact, each of our thoughts, feelings, and decisions is the inexorable result of determinants, myriad determinants, genetic determinants, cultural, religious, familial, educational, historical, all of these acting like a kind of magnetic field that pulls our thinking and our decision-making towards a certain pattern or certain habits or certain expectations. So that's the topic on the floor. Perhaps Harrison would like to talk a little bit about the relevance of the topic, both legally and philosophically.
Well, yes, thank you. Obviously, we could be here for hours, maybe days.
But we won't be.
No, we won't.
Certainly, not with breakfast waiting.
It has been discussed for thousands of years. This problem of free will versus determinism has puzzled philosophers throughout the ages. It is a profound problem and important because without free will, there can be no morality, no right or wrong, no good or evil. If either God or the events of the universe in some mechanical way determine everything that happens, then the next thing I do, the next word I say, or whether I drink this glass of water, is going to not be a choice that I make, but something predetermined by I'm thirsty because of what I ate for breakfast, and I ate for breakfast what was in the fridge because Stephanie went shopping, and on and on and on. Or I have the choice of picking up a glass of water and drinking. And this then goes down to morality. Do you have a responsibility for a legal action or a moral ethic or a moral thinking if you don't have free will? Now, common sense and also Darwinian evolution apparently suggests that, in fact, we do have free will, that we can decide and determine our futures within the limits of physical reality. However, the only way, absolute way to solve this problem is to know what exists and how it is interconnected, that is, a true knowledge of reality. And that's where Caballerian philosophy has something to say. And so this concept of free will versus determinism, I lost my thought. I'm sure we'll come back to it. It is ultimately, in the current thinking, is a sort of a concept, an understanding of limited free will, in that we do have to deal with the reality of life, but within that reality we have free will. And as a matter of fact, that's the Buddhist concept on it. They're very practical people. They teach that the idea of absolute free will is foolish because it denies the reality of one's physical needs and circumstances. They also teach that equally incorrect is the idea that we have no choice. To deny freedom would undermine our efforts to make moral progress. And in the Caballerian point of view, the purpose of life is growth, is to grow from that small child who is only aware of its own self to grow towards the concept of universal love and universal understanding and universal concept and universal consciousness. I think that.
So we have a topic to examine, and in the Kabbalarian philosophy, we try to approach all questions about life through our consistent basic framework, which we refer to as the five basic truths: mathematics, language, name, mind, and consciousness. So let's take a look at mathematics. We recognize that all finite life manifests through various principles. And when those principles are studied and understood, then we're able to see patterns and predict outcomes to a great extent. However, life is dual. It's abstract as well as finite, and this recognition of duality is at the very heart of the Kabbalarian teachings, that life as a whole is the expression of a great universal power of intelligence, of universal reason, which Mr. Parker often referred to as God the principle. Significant. So the why, the abstract part, is vast and infinite and beyond our finite comprehension, but it has to involve itself in the finite reality in order to have any expression. Without the reason, there's no point to the reality. And without the reality, there's no fulfillment, there's no expression of the reason. It's like two halves of the coin. You know, they're inseparable. We can look at each side separately for purposes of analysis, but it's one coin. So the abstract, being without form, cannot be measured, but the finite, manifesting through specific, observable, measurable attributes like length or width or height or weight or speed or frequency, is both a demonstration and an expression of the principle of mathematics, which is the key to our understanding of life. So this principle of mathematics is a core teaching of the philosophy and is a critical feature of the finite realm. If a thing has measurable properties, it's mathematical by definition, whether or not we choose to measure it. So that's a principle. Now, if we look at the theory of determinism, is there any determinant relative to a mathematical principle? Well, when you add 2 plus 2, you expect a consistent answer, don't you? You expect that it's going to be 4. So there's a principle of addition here. There's a principle of subtraction. There's a principle of cube roots. All of these mathematical principles are, in fact, determinants. So whenever a principle is invoked, you initiate cause and effect. You set up cause and effect. So to this degree, the theory of determinism has some validity. But one thing determinists, as far as we're aware, do not recognize is, for example, that aspect of mathematics we refer to as the law of cycles. And these are not so much determinants in the sense that they guarantee a specific outcome, as they set up conditions, they create environments which are conducive to certain appropriate courses of action. But the human mind is capable of overriding those conditions. So you may be in a one cycle, but for any one of many possible reasons, you're either unable to take action, or you're lazy because you don't know that you should be doing something, or your name has influences that are getting in the way of that natural inclination. And so you, in a sense, override the natural rhythm of the cycles, and life doesn't work out as smoothly, as constructively as you might like. So there's a whole world there. I mean, we could spend just an hour on that alone. But the point is here that cycles are not recognized in this theory of determinism. And when we say that an individual is going to make a particular choice or response based on his determinants, whether they're genetic or cultural or from upbringing or whatever, that completely overlooks the fact that the very same individual may make completely different choices in completely different cycles. So it's a major flaw or gap in the theory. So mathematics is the first pillar of the Kabbalarian teachings, and because of time, we're going to move very quickly through here, but we'll ask Harrison to talk about the second pillar.
Well, the second pillar, of course, is language. This is the second pillar of the foundation of our philosophy. And I think the key point about language the recognition of the Kabbalah philosophy is that it is language that separates humankind from all other species, and that it is language that is what gives us our intelligence, rather than the other way around. You know, evolutionists think that man developed intelligence first and then invented language. Looking from a holistic top-down picture, as Mr. Parker did, we see the concept of reason, as Stephanie was saying, abstract, becoming involved in life through the breath and through mathematics and being awakened through breath, evolving through language, through man's human mind, that it requires a conscious mind on the physical plane, a finite plane, to express the potential of the abstract plane. And we use language even to think. And it's the only medium through which we can explain this invisible intelligence, which is responsible for the other half of that duality. We use language to do everything. The minute we use language, it's no longer abstract, but it is still important. And language is, the intelligence in language is based on a mathematical progression of sounds that we tend to put in an alphabet. And we know when we put it in an alphabet, then we see the key chart, then we can give certain qualities to certain sounds or certain symbols. And when we take those qualities and apply them, or those certain sounds or symbols, to a name and apply them to a human mind, as Harrison or Stephanie, then we can relate those back to the alphabet in whatever language, in this case English, and we can determine certain qualities that will express through that person's mind based on the label or the name that that person is given. It's almost like although the DNA may be the core of the structure of the foundation of the intelligence of building the body cells, the name is like the DNA of the mind, and it is the core. And so when a child is born and they take that first breath, a potential is born within them, but they are not yet intelligent. When we give them a name and we bring them into human society, they will then start to grow, and they will start to observe and think and integrate. And everything that they think and grow will be colored by the frequency of that name. So Stephanie will talk about name now.
Go ahead.
The third pillar.
You go ahead.
Shall I carry on? Okay. Yes, all right. So the name, then, is the third pillar in the foundation of our teachings. And it is a powerful determinant, but it's not the only determinant. And Stephanie has already described determinants. I don't have to go any further on that. There is a certain validity there. There is this concept of cause and effect. But I didn't know Mr. Parker very well. I was very young, but I think anyone who knew him would have said that he believed in free will. And our concept, going back to cycles, is, in the Kabbalah philosophy, is there's a time to sow and a time to reap, and as you sow, so shall you reap. And the emphasis is on the sowing. If we put a seed in the ground, we will reap something. If we don't put a seed in the ground, then nothing will happen. And to me, that is what I would consider free will. We could say, and they do say, that evolution, that the bacteria, if you have a bacteria and you start washing with bacteria-killing soap, the bacteria is going to evolve to a new form that will be immune to the poison in the soap. And they might consider that free will. But it is a free action on the part of the bacteria species. Individual bacteria are going to die, and the strain of bacteria is going to change and carry on. I can get up from this chair. I can exercise my free will and choose to get up from this chair and leave this hall and leave Stephanie to do the rest of the talk by herself. Of course, I could also, I would also have to then
you'd be invoking the law of cause and effect, of course.
Exactly. I'd have to buy a doghouse.
Yeah.
So I could get up from this chair, or I'll choose because of my commitments I've made, my training, my respect for our principal and for my wife, to stay here. A bird may sit here and then get up, or a cat may sit here and get up, as well as myself. And they will do so for different reasons and different stimulus. It seems that the more intelligence there is in the species, the more free will it is. We couldn't say that an animal, and I don't think any of these philosophers do say that an animal has free will, even though it has free action. And yet a human being does. And in the Calvinian philosophy, we understand that this is because of the specialness of the human mind, because the human is linked to the universal source. The human has a potential to learn and to grow and to express on a much broader level than a cat or a bird.
So if I might jump in here for a moment, just getting back then more specifically to the concept of name as a determinant, it certainly does help to shape the choices that are made, the tastes, the preferences, and it makes certain choices of a much higher probability. But at any given point, we are free to compare with new information. We are free to analyze. And so if we rely on even the concept of our name as a determinant, it's basically just using excuses, isn't it? Whereas if we recognize that maybe for an because of an unbalanced name or whatever reason, there are certain limitations, the minute that we hear some truth, the minute that we hear an explanation of some facet of the philosophy, for instance, and that universal potential that comes into us with the first breath, that spark begins to resonate, begins to vibrate in response to that universal truth, then we are empowered to make some different choices. We may choose to change our name, to balance our name, so that instead of a name that restricts and limits the expression of that universal power, we now have a broader channel through which that power can express. So again, I want to repeat that quote, which is from a recent discussion. The human is linked to the universal source, which has no determinants. And so both theories apply in certain areas. Both theories have some validity. There are definitely determining factors that shape our lives. But for most people, those are basically just what we, in the computer language, we'd call the default mode. You know, no conscious intervention. No change to customize it to our personal test. You know, somebody like me sits down in a computer. All I want to do is type. Please don't clutter me up with a lot of stuff I don't think I'll ever use. Just show me the on button and let me type. And send that email, whatever, I'm happy. Somebody else wants to know all the layers behind, wants to know how it works. I don't feel I need that, but maybe someone else does. But I'm happy with the default mode for that specific part of my life. But sit me down, maybe teaching a piano lesson, and I need to know a lot more than the default mode, don't I? Because every learner has different requirements, and so my brain has to have a lot more tools at its disposal. So we all make these choices based on the need of our situation. But here's the point, that we do respond somehow, some way. We've seen it in ourselves. We've seen it in many, many, many visitors. When truth is expressed, when universal truth is expressed, it stirs a response and it empowers us to make choices that are now no longer just in that lowest common denominator default mode, but are now more creative choices, more free choices. And so the name that we have determines our mind's ability to rise above these finite factors. And so you give a little youngster a 459 name, and that's a determinant that's going to set up some very discordant effects in the life of the youngster. Cause and effect. Cause and effect is a principle, isn't it? When you give a child a balanced name, then you're allowing that natural inner potential much wider scope. It doesn't mean that the balanced name acts like a guaranteed, inevitable working out of a perfect life, attracting millions, having the most wonderful love affair of the century, becoming famous and getting 15 minutes of fame on the Oprah talk show. That's not what it's about. But it gives us tools with which we can have a much wider range, a much wider field for making intelligent choices and fulfilling our life's purpose. And I think we do need to move on to mine.
Yes,
do you want to start that?
Sure. But just one point. As long as we are thinking logically, we are in control of our thinking. We can exercise free will. When we start to react emotionally, then we are lessening our responsibility, and we are acting in this default mode. We are lowering our level of free will, and we're reacting, again, based on determinants. So how our father, disciplined, or how something that happened to our mother, you know, when we were very, very young. The other day I heard a lunch speaker, and he was talking about street people in downtown East Side, and he had gone down, he'd met this street man who had been on the street for 30 years, and he asked him, well, how did you get there? And the man said, well, you know, he said, my mother was murdered when I was 6 years old. Now, that man just couldn't get beyond that point, and his whole life was defined 30 years later by this thought. In the Kabbalah philosophy, we recognize that you have to grow beyond that. You have to close the door on scars like that, and you have to grow and change. Some people can, and some people can't. And most people don't know what causes that. In the Kabbalah philosophy, we do know a balanced name gives you the ability to change. Let's poll our studio audience here. How many people believe that they have free will? How many people believe that their lives are determined? The whole audience were on the free will side. Most of you, I believe all of you, have balanced names. If we ask someone with a 549 name or a 191 name or one destiny perhaps, that same question, I wonder what they would say. They don't have as much. So the next concept in the five basic truths is the concept of mind. And in determinist theory, this is basically equated with the brain. And the major difference in concept is the Kabbalarians recognize that the brain, however complex, is merely the physical organ through which one's mental energies can express. The mind is the expression of universal potential. And where does the mind live? Where does the awareness live? Does it live in the body? Does it live in the brain? No, it actually lives in a thought world that is separate from the physical. We can close our, we receive input, physical input, and we receive mental input of memories and things like that, and we process all of that, and we create a consciousness and an awareness that we live within. But we can prove that we can close that off, and I can be thinking of being on a beach in Hawaii right now instead of being in Vancouver. And if I was focused strong enough, that's all I would see and hear and believe. The other interesting thing about that, though, is that my mind is not totally separate and closed, that we share a group mind, and I can be influenced, depending on how strong my thinking is, by your thinking or the thinking of someone else. If I'm on that plane of mind of sitting on a beach in Hawaii, I'm thinking about sitting in the sunshine in Hawaii like all thousands of other people who are actually sitting in the sunshine in Hawaii, and I'm sharing that plane of mind or that group mind with them. So we recognize in the Kabbalah philosophy that it is important to follow a constructive path and because if we don't, then we are open to suggestions, mental interference, and when we express all of the negative qualities of the 1 to 9 mental qualities and the numbers, we are then going to the plane of mind of the expression of that quality, like greed or lust or jealousy, and we tune in to the plane of mind of all the people that are thinking that same thing. When we tune in to the positive qualities of those numbers, we are then drawing from the universal potential that we have.
It's interesting, isn't it? I remember being very impressed by a Kabbalarian speaker many years ago who was giving a talk and saying that when people are the most selfish, they're actually the most linked to mass negativity. And when they feel the most big and universal, they're in fact being the most individual. Because there is this world of thought. I had an interesting thought this morning. You know how when you go to a website on the computer, I don't know why I'm giving computer examples of all things, but, you know, there's that www dot whatever, World Wide Web. Well, there's actually a WWTW, a worldwide thought web, which existed long before the world of computers and will always exist as long as life exists. And it is a very similar example, actually. There are so many links. There are the portals, there are the back doors, there are the viruses in this world of thought. So whenever we drop our vibration, whenever we give way to feeling sorry for ourselves, feeling critical, gossiping, being angry because somebody doesn't drive the way we think they should, or any of these little openings, then we are living on an emotional level which has millions of mental companions. And whenever we consciously close the door to that thought, that irritant, and say, I choose not to be upset. I choose not to be a gossip. I choose to be understanding and tolerant. Then we're drawing from the constructive expression of the qualities from 1 to 9, and we are linking ourselves, our minds, and our energies with this universal source, this limitless source. And so then we are elevated above the determinants that plague the lives of so many, and we open the door to the possibility of a more creative way of life. So I'd like to move into that fifth pillar of consciousness, because consciousness is our purpose as humans, isn't it? To express on a conscious level. Now, I think it's important when we use similes or examples which are not taken directly from the teachings that we identify them. So I'm going to do that. I'd like to use an example here. This is not from the official teachings. This is just the result of an observation over many years of working with hundreds of varying ages in the teaching field. But when it comes to consciousness, it would appear that the first stage is the sensory awareness of the infant. And the second stage, and the specific ages for these are going to be pretty flexible depending on many factors, but from approximately 1 to approximately 3 years of age, you see the linguistic development happening. That little infant is still very highly colored by the wants and the needs of the little self. I want it. Give it to me. Take me there. Pick me up. And as they get a little older, give or take ages 2 to 5 or higher, they start to merge into the third stage of awareness, the beginning of small c consciousness, perhaps. This is where they go through that socializing process, and they're introduced to concepts of manners and hygiene and rudimentary discipline, taking turns, saying please and thank you, with widely varying results, depending on the concept of the parents and the environment, the neighborhood. I mean, speaking as one who has worked in the cosmopolitan city of Vancouver on the east side, the west side, that one component is very powerful. It is a determinant, no question about it. The expectations are hugely different. And where the home is refined and there's a recognition of the importance of these things like manners, the socializing process begins in the cradle, and it is non-stop. And it's just so impressive when you happen to meet a family where the child of, you know, you watch them from when you first meet them at 3 on up to 8, 9, and never, for example, are they allowed to leave a situation without saying, thank you. How impressive is this in today's world? But they get to a certain age, and this is very, very general, but on average, I'd have to say it's about 5 years of age when the peer pressure really sets in. Now, up to this point, the human awareness, the consciousness, doesn't go much beyond what many animals can be trained for. But at this point, the peer pressure starts, and so I'm calling this the fourth stage, where they begin to recognize cause and effect. You act a little different, you get scorned. Very powerful. But it's also the start of analysis. Do I want to go that way, or do I want to go the other way? They see unfairness, and they start to question it. And this is, you know, again, start of analysis. But because of the peer pressure, they're often terribly vulnerable to mass and often very negative planes of mind. So it's a very, very sensitive, very dangerous stage. Now, the fifth stage can happen anywhere from, you know, 8 or 9 and up into the mid-teens. But at this point, they start to wonder a little bit more individually, and they start to challenge a little bit more individually. And they're looking more for cause and effect. And the sixth stage, which can be, again, really any age, but it's often in the mid-teens up to the mid-20s or even beyond, they start to formulate more personal attitudes and beliefs and habits, and the individuality on one level begins. And the peer pressure can diminish a little bit, or it becomes more selective. So you get a young person in this stage, and maybe they've made a decision that they couldn't care less about football, so they're not interested in the opinions of classmates who are rabid football fans, or vice versa. Maybe some teenage boy decides he couldn't care less about what a girl thinks about ballet. So he's now selecting the areas in which he's going to be open to peer pressure and just closing the door. He could care less about the others. It's a very limited form of individuality, but it's the beginning. And then I'm suggesting that there's a seventh stage, which, again, can be any age, but it often begins to happen in the late teens or early 20s. The mind is now beginning to face disappointments or injustices or disillusionment, or sometimes they're just sated by physical experience, or fed up with not having any sense of purpose. And this is very, very valuable because now they start questioning why and why not on a different level. And now the mind is actually ready to look deeper into life and into purpose. And at this point, you know, this is opening the path to an understanding of the philosophy. And it could be the beginning of genuine free will. Because hopefully they'll go on to the eighth stage where they find the principle and they test it and they learn about it and they begin to trust it. And we could call that the dawning of large C consciousness, where there's a higher level of responsibility, because then they would go on to a ninth stage where they start to give back. They want to share. They want to live for a purpose rather than just for self, and could go on even further to stages where through self-discipline and study, there's a much clearer understanding, and life opens up so that we're not limited to such an extent by the finite, and we can give share concepts of mental and spiritual development. So, you know, it's just an example, but it's about the fact that consciousness has so many different layers, but it's only when we start to recognize that there's more to life than the material things and begin to question that we begin to free ourselves of the usual, what we might call default determinants of genetics and cultural and religious conditioning. Harrison?
Yes. We never stop being influenced by those determinants to some degree, as long as we're still breathing and functioning in the finite plane, but we can free ourselves to a greater and greater degree as we learn to understand the universal principles and to merge with our inner purpose as humans, which is to become instruments for the expression of universal reason, which, being infinite, has no determinants. As we choose to do this, we are exerting our free will to a greater and greater degree. Here's another quote from Schopenhauer, Stephanie was quoting earlier. This is a little bit bigger quote. Everyone believes himself to be perfectly free, even in his individual actions, and thinks that at every moment he can commence another manner of life. But through experience, he finds to his astonishment that he is not free, but subjected to necessity, that in spite of all his resolutions and reflections, he does not change his conduct, and that from the beginning of his life to the end of it, he must carry out the very character which he himself condemns. Well, Mr. Schopenhauer's first name was Arthur, 415, and he didn't have a balanced name. And so he felt that he must carry out the very character that he condemned throughout his life and didn't have the opportunity to change. Once a person balances their name and learns about the principle, then their mind is awakened. And we asked on the teleconference a week ago this question because we were wanting to discuss it. And it was so interesting how the speaker, coming from a top-down approach, drilled right down to the basic concept, the clear concept that the more that once we become aware of our purpose and our ability to grow and start to work with that, then we are starting to work with free will. We are drawing from this infinite highest attainment possible, this infinite universal reason. Kabbalistic philosophy teaches that this is the highest attainment for every human being to elevate their concept and vibration sufficiently to merge with universal concept. In other words, to see all questions from the clearest and most vast and unlimited perspective possible. To become aware of the interrelationship of all things, to see the unity of all things, and to comprehend humanity's role not on a point-by-point basis, but holistically complete and perfect. We should move on.
Yes, I was going to suggest that we just move right along here.
Yeah.
But I do want to just touch on where original ideas would come from then, whether you're talking about Edison's light bulb or Beethoven's choral symphony or Buckminster Fuller's geodesic dome or the idea of computer chips. I mean, these are things that had not appeared before as far as we're aware, and it reinforces the thought that when you are in the primary stages of any field, you're basically functioning within preset determinants, but the degree to which you master that field and reach into the abstract potential, and this requires mastery, it requires energy, and it requires a focused concept, but to the degree that we're able to do that, we can actually then bring into form things that had not previously been expressed. And once a thing has been discovered, It seems so inevitable. You know, how could it have been any other way? Look at a plane flying. We take it for granted. Pick up a telephone. We take it for granted. How could it have been any other way? It's just so logical. But there was a time when that didn't exist. And someone had to conceive it and experiment and work to bring it into form. So there are, as we started out by saying, many theories about various aspects of life. And the weakness of most of them is that they address one or two specific phenomena without integrating into a complete basic explanation. And the beauty of Mr. Parker's teachings was this holistic quality, starting with the big picture and working systematically through each facet. And even the question of free will versus determinism is actually another illustration of the principle of duality. So once again, determinism is like the finite or the default process, and free will allows us to draw from the infinite, from the abstract, and it's achieved or created through a combination of energy plus concept. So the philosophy teaches that really the spark has a purpose to express, and the prize at the end of the rainbow is not free will per se, it's what we refer to as mental freedom. And mental freedom is a state of mind, as we understand it, where we are no longer limited by the genetic determinants, by the emotional pulls, by the influence of peer pressure or mass planes of mind, because we've achieved a stability, a calmness, a clarity, and a reliance on trustworthy principles that will work for us in all circumstances. And to finish, we'd like to say that from a similar recent discussion, we as humans are only limited by the limitations of our own thinking. And as we rise above those, we are above all determinants. Regardless of environment and genetics, it is possible for that universal life force to achieve total freedom. Of course, as students of the Cavalarian philosophy, that is our collective goal, isn't it? We want to thank the listener who sent in the topic. It's been very interesting doing some study on this topic, and we encourage any other listeners or anyone here, if they have a suggestion, to share it with us. We may not always be able to address it immediately, but it's fun to have a particular kind of angle to work on, something that allows us to review our basic material, but see how it relates and cross-references to other theories in life.